Yes, my name is Matt. I'm the head of the systems team at Weta Digital. The systems team is responsible for all the servers, the storage, and the networking. All that's handled by us. Just a little bit of background history about the company. Weta was founded in 1993 by Sir Peter Jackson, Sir Richard Taylor, and Jamie Selkirk. They put it together to do digital effects for the movie Heavenly Creatures. And it's been going ever since then, like you said, through Lord of the Rings, King Kong. We have 5 Academy Awards for all 3 Lord of the Rings movies, King Kong, and now Avatar. One thing I like to point out at the start of most talks is Weta is not an acronym. That is a Weta. It's an indigenous cricket in New Zealand. These things actually exist and wander around Wellington, where Weta is. And just before I get started, I just want to go over a little bit of film terminology, just to make things a little bit easier to understand in case I slip back into that. A lot of times in movies, we talk about 3D. You go see Avatar in 3D. 3D has a very technical meaning inside the visual effects community. So we refer to everything as stereo. We don't deal with sound. We only deal with images. So there's no ambiguity for us. The basic sequence of how we compose a movie is we start with a frame. A frame is a single image. There are about 24 of those a second in a standard film. Those are grouped into shots. A shot is a continuous camera movement, so a series of frames. Those are grouped into scenes, which are a related group of shots, which are then grouped into sequences, which are edited together into a final film. And that's the structure that our pipeline takes. Also refer to something we call slots. A slot is a render task, or what some people call a job. So we can run multiple slots on a single server, and that refers to how many jobs we're running at any given time. So one thing that's interesting about our company is our scheduling. And by scheduling, I mean the way we work day to day. We do work on a day-to-day basis. Our workflow is really iterative. So the artists come in the morning, review the work that they did yesterday, sit down with the director, go over it, get notes, what he likes, what he didn't like, what they need to work on today. They go work on that the rest of the day, submit it to the render wall to be rendered overnight, come back in the morning and see the results of that. So we're actually sort of a mixture between a high-performance shop where we have to render these images as fast as we can, because they have to be done by the morning. And we're also kind of a mixture of high availability. So we're not running a research lab. We're not doing sort of nuclear weapons research, where if we have something go down for days on end, you know, whatever, the Soviet Union will always be there next week, right? No, the director doesn't wait. We have to have work in front of him every day. So we've had to make some compromises kind of on both sides, on the high availability side and the high performance side, and come up with a little bit of a hybrid. And I think we've been pretty successful with that. So our schedule is really people driven. The computer's answer to the people, not the other way around. It's also a real strong day-night cycle. We're busiest during the night. During the day, it's more interactive work where artists are in doing everything. Although, as you can imagine, towards the end of a movie, it essentially turns into a 24-hour cycle where we're rendering 24 hours a day and there's staff in 24 hours a day. One of the major constraints that we have to deal with is that we are one of the biggest visual effects facilities in the world. We do develop a lot of in-house software, but we use mostly commercial off-the-shelf software, packages like Maya for doing modeling and animation, texture painting packages. Most of our rendering is done with PR Man, Photorealistic Render Man from Pixar, and Shake and Nuke for doing compositing. These are all off-the-shelf packages that are meant to run in small visual effects houses that maybe have 10 people, all the way up to something of our size. But there aren't many facilities of our size, so the software's not really optimized for it. So as part of this, we have to run the same operating system everywhere. For Avatar, we were running Kubuntu 7.04. P people don't believe me when I tell them that. But we have to run exactly the same image on the render wall as we do on the desktop. If someone tries something on the desktop, sees that it works, likes the output, and then submits it to the render wall to finish processing on a larger scale, he needs to see exactly what he saw on his desktop. We can't have software incompatibilities. We can't have kernel incompatibilities, none of that. We do optimize the render wall one somewhat and do things like turn off cups, X isn't running. But we don't even really put a lot of effort into that. It's a really pretty standard image. The other thing we have is we're an NFS shop. Everything is NFS. There are small corners of the facility that deal with things like Samba, but it's typically Samba reshared NFS or Apple Talk or something. But the production network is all NFS, so NFS everywhere. We live and die by it. All the software is installed on the network. The OS images are really, really bare. So even on the render wall, when it needs to get RenderMan and all its libraries loaded, it's doing it over NFS. I'll show you the size of the problem that we have to deal with. This is a graph of the disk usage over time. Fellowship of the Ring was only 15 terabytes. I say only, at the time it was gigantic. But you can see Fellowship of the Ring, Two Towers, Return of the King, and then Lord of the Rings in total was about 135 terabytes. King Kong, our next big movie, was about 120. So almost as big as all three movies put together. I threw this one in there just for a comparison. We had 102 terabytes of RAM on the render wall for Avatar. We almost could have rendered Lord of the Rings in RAM. Avatar took a little over 900 terabytes of active working set. We have a big tape storage system. We have some other slower storage. But this is really the sort of maximum working set of data that we have to deal with. Just to show you guys some pictures, this is how we buy RAM. This is how we buy disks. These are all disks from BlueArc. Our primary storage providers for Avatar were BlueArc and NetApp. And we split the spindles pretty evenly between the two of them. So also to show you the size of our render wall over time, we call it a render wall, some people call it a render farm. It's ours, we call it a render wall. Back in the beginning of Lord of the Rings, all the rendering would have been done on a giant SGI, so we would have had only a few of those. But that's not the way it's done anymore. Now it's all parallel on commodity hardware. So over time, it's sort of come and gone, different systems. But you can see the spike that we had to purchase to get through Avatar. We have 4,352 nodes. They all have 24 gigs of RAM. They did have 16. We upgraded, hence the palette. It's divided up into chunks of 742 servers on the top 500 list. The reason it's done that way is because in order to get a consistent score, you have to run the Linpack benchmark. We've run the Linpack benchmark on small parts of our render wall and estimated that it would take probably 10 or 11 days to run a complete test on the entire thing. We never have 10 or 11 days off, ever. So we just can't run the test. So it's just divided into smaller ones. We started about 279 on the top 500 list. A new one will be coming out next week, and we'll get pushed down. But this week, we're starting at 279. In order to house all these, we've built a very efficient green data center. They're all water-cooled for efficiency. Our PUE, for anybody that knows what those are, is 113. And we use a lot of free cooling, given the, let's say, temperate climate in Wellington. This is just something I calculated the other day. New Zealand's a small country. We have a really big supercomputer. We actually have the highest peak gigaflops per capita in the world. I do have to give a little bit of credit. There's another supercomputer in the country from NIWA, the guys that calculate the weather. But we're much bigger than they are. So another problem that we face that's a little bit different than most people, I think, is our ratio of server to disk is different than a lot of, especially enterprise applications. So if you think of the way people sort of historically build enterprise storage, you'll say, you know, I need an Oracle database, so I'll get a big beefy server, and then I'll attach some sort of RAID system to it. So I'll have some server with some number of cores and a larger number of disks in order to get performance. Because we do so much CPU computing, ours is actually kind of reverse of that. So we have almost 5,000 servers. We can run three or four jobs at a time, so three or four slots. We had about 16,500 available render slots when we were doing Avatar. So those are the number of tasks running at any given time. There's a particular category of disks, which I'll get into later, called DAT disks, which are the write disks. These are where the render wall writes its output to. So these things get really heavily utilized. We had 2,780 of those during Avatar. That includes parity. Everything was RAID 6, double parity. That includes hot spares. So we end up with a ratio of about six jobs running to every spindle that they're writing to. And that creates a lot of problems. If you turn the attention of the render wall at a particular file system, you can very quickly reduce it to a puddle of metal. Our core network gets very busy. We're all 10 gigabit Ethernet everywhere, except finally to the render blades, which are only gigabit. But our core network between the storage and the render wall will get up over 100 gigabits per second when we're busy rendering. I just wanted to show you something else really quickly too, which is what happens to all this data, right? So it took us 905 terabytes of active storage to render Avatar. So what actually happens to that? Well, the final movie, if you take the raw HD frames and go over the run length of the movie, you know, 162 minutes for the original version, it ends up just under 4 terabytes. So we take our almost petabyte of data. What you see on the screen is only about 4 terabytes. In reality, the only way you can see uncompressed data on the screen the way we see it is to see it on film. But you can't see 3D films on film anymore. So everybody sees it in digital cinema, which is compressed with JPEG 2000, which is supposed to be visually lossless. It looks really good. So that drops it right down to about 300 gigs, which is enough to fit on a hard drive, which is what the cinemas are aiming at. And then down on the right is a Blu-ray, which is how you see it at home. You're only seeing about 40 gigabytes of the nearly petabyte of data that we showed. And it gets worse. So that's what you see at the cinema, that's what you see at home, and on the right is probably how most people see it. So you're seeing approximately, you know, even a DVD is only 8 gigs. So you really are, this is just my way of encouraging people to still please go see it in the cinema. If you want to see what we really work hard to produce, the best way to see it is still in the cinema. Don't make me waste all this disk. So Avatar was hard. That's one way of putting it. It took about 56 million render hours to produce Avatar. 56 million hours is a lot. That's about 6,400 years. The way we get through that, obviously, is by doing it in parallel, by having a lot of machines and having the machines run multiple jobs. We delivered about 211,000 frames to the client. So that was our contribution to the movie. That comes out at about 266 hours a frame. And we did all this in 2 years. So that's really, it's 11 days per frame. So how do we get here? We'll take a step back and go back to the sort of Lord of the Rings days, and growing from, you know, the tiny amount of data then to the big amount of data now, and some of the problems we faced. So in the beginning, I think it's a common story at a lot of visual effects houses. They'll go from sort of running things on people's desktops to wanting to centralize it and having maybe a little bit of a render wall. So you bring in a storage appliance, you go buy a NetApp, you throw that there, that's great. Now you have all the storage available. You can do that until you hit the 16T file size limit that I'm sure anybody that used to use NetApps was familiar with. And even that would have been all right. We could have done the first Lord of the Rings movie within the 16T limit. But eventually you grow beyond that and you have to get your second NetApp. And now what do? You don't have a single file system anymore. Well, the easiest thing to do is just to have a second file system and number it, and that's what was done. So we had Vol Frames 1, and Vol Frames 2, and Vol Frames 3. And somebody would just manually allocate it. You'd say, well, we have a new shot coming in. And I said, well, there's some space over on this file system there. Why don't you use that? And you would, and then you'd finish it and delete it, and you know, somebody else would do it. It was all manual. And it also meant that when there was a single busy shot, that entire filer would be busy. The other ones could be idle, but anybody else working on a shot contending with you would tend to lose out. And once you start bringing a render wall in and having a render wall with multiple machines contending with users just with desktops, the render wall always wins. So it gets really frustrating for artists who are trying to load files or save files or even do interactive things like drag things around. And it's waiting for disk, and it's waiting for disk, and it's waiting for disk. So we started to think about splitting our data into stuff that the render wall would produce and stuff that humans had to deal with. And that became the categories that we call source and dat. So source is everything that's human generated, and dat is everything that's render wall generated. So how would you keep track of all this stuff? How would you keep track of which parts of the shot go where? Well, we started doing basic templating, where you would run a script that says, I want to create a new shot. It would create some directories in a standard path structure. And then it would shove some of them off onto fast disk so that the render wall could access that without affecting the artists. And then it would just symlink it. So you had a single directory structure with some symlinks pointing off to faster disk. And that works okay. You know, that gets you so far. We made a lot of movies that way. Just to go back to the two categories and the distinction that we finally came up with and how that affects our storage decisions. So source is everything that's human generated. It has to be good for interactive use. We have really expensive artists, a lot of them sitting around waiting. If they have to wait for files to open, if they have to wait to save things, that's all wasted time. But it's really important data. A human had to sit down and create it. So it's snapshotted. So in case they delete something, they can just pull it back out of snapshots. It's backed up to tape in case they delete something older than that. Data is generated by the render wall. It just needs to be fast. In theory, if you lose it, no big deal. You just run the render again. All you've lost is time. You haven't lost original content and data. In practice, that turns out to be a little bit harder. And that's mostly because the software pipeline is a moving target. So it'd be really difficult for us, you know, at the moment, let's say, to pull a shot from Lord of the Rings back off tape and expect to render it exactly the same way we did back then. All the software is different. None of the those versions are available, et cetera. So essentially, the render wall's job is to transform source into dat. That's what it does. It could almost treat the source file systems as read-only and the dat file systems as write-only, although it does write out a lot of stuff to dat that gets used in further stages of processing. So the next evolution of the SHOT templating was a system we call DSMS, which is Disk Space Management System. And that started to be written around the end of Lord of the Rings and before King Kong in 2003. And basically, it's just an evolution of the SHOT template script, where it does things dynamically instead of statically. So what we do is we use NFS to store essentially our global namespace metadata. And we have a file system that we call a link farm. And all that consists of are directories and symlinks. That's it. There's no data in it whatsoever. And that's your global file system directory tree. And it's just an extension of that earlier one where you would say, this directory actually needs to be a symlink off onto fast storage. So we have all these templates now where you say, I need a shot that looks roughly like this. And it'll create the whole directory tree. And it knows for each kind of data whether it needs to be, you know, for example, backed up and put on a source file system, or whether the render wall is going to hit it and it needs to go on a dat file system. And it'll do that. But instead of having hard-coded paths and everything, there's a database that keeps track of the available space on all existing file systems. So when it says, okay, I need some storage of this type, it can ask for any file system that has that much storage available. It'll then pick one randomly and create a symlink there. So even within the same shot, different directories will be spread out across many different filers, which means when that shot gets busy, let's say it has a deadline and we're using a significant portion of the render wall to render that shot, it's spreading the load out among multiple filers and not just hitting any one. Now, why do we like this system? Well, we like it because it's simple. We didn't really write our own global file system. We kind of cheated and we just used symlinks. You can really think of a symlink in this sense. From a web point of view, it's like a 302 redirect, right? So we just have one file system sitting there, and all it does is say, you're looking for this directory, it's over there. You're looking for that directory, it's over there. And that's all it does. But it works anywhere. If we get a third-party system in, let's say some customized software for an editing package or something, and they don't want to run our version of Linux, that's fine. Everybody understands symlinks. It's all written in Perl. All the scripts are written in Perl. Nothing's compiled. It's never segfaulted. It's never panicked a kernel. If it breaks, you can fix it. You can fix it with ln. You can fix it with rm. You can fix it with mv. It's all very understandable. It would be really difficult. In fact, I can't really think of a way to sort of have global file system corruption. The worst that can happen sometimes is something goes wrong and a shot gets messed up for whatever reason. And you can either recreate it and start over, or you can figure out what would have, you know, what should have happened and fix it by hand. Another really nice thing is that it's vendor agnostic. So we're not tied into any particular vendor. We can have and do have different vendors' file systems on the same shot for the same kind of data, really. So I just wanted to show you quickly how our disk space grew over time, and also show the distinction. The sort of orange line is the dat data. And the blue line down at the bottom is source. So that's human generated. It just grows slowly over time. People can only click the mouse so fast. People can only type so fast. The render wall, on the other hand, can get a little bit out of control. We can create 40 T of data a day overnight. And that's actually not really stating the entire case. Our total data can grow 40 T overnight. That also includes things that are being deleted all the time. So basically, this is what a typical film for us looks like. We have to buy a lot of disk, get it done, and then spend the next year draining it all back off onto tape. So some people ask me why we didn't go to something like Lustre, which is another sort of parallel file system. But Lustre 1.0 came out in 2003, which is when we were already deploying DSMS. So they were really sort of contemporary developments, and it wasn't really an option. One thing that sort of true parallel file systems offer is the ability to stripe files across multiple file systems. We can't do that. If we took it to the ultimate extension of this, every file that we created could be behind a symlink. And the link farm could just be symlinks to every file. But that's taking it a lot farther than we have. Generally, we only go to the directory level. But things like Lustre and other parallel file systems are really metadata heavy. For something like Lustre, they recommend that you reserve 1 to 2% of your total storage for metadata. So on something like Avatar, that's 10 or 20 terabytes. It's not a huge amount. I mean, we could have done it, but it's 10 or 20 terabytes. The Avatar link farm was 24 gigabytes. That fits in RAM. The link farm filer can contain everything in RAM. It's really fast. It was only about 3.7 million files, which is a lot of symlinks, but you're not keeping track of blocks. It also doesn't really make sense given our sort of file size distribution. These are just a few source file systems and a few DAT file systems that I picked. You can see from this, there's most of our files are sort of around 64K to a meg. We have a lot of small files. There's kind of a burst in the sort of 16 meg category because that's the size of an output frame. So when the render wall is outputting full frames, that's it. But we don't really have a lot of big files. So if you're going to do a parallel file system, actually stripe a file across multiple filers, you have to pick a stripe size, right? You do like a sort of basic NFS 8K, or maybe a more optimized 32K. But when your files are tiny, it means maybe they end up on 2, maybe they end up on 1, maybe they end up on 3. It doesn't really buy us a lot. It's more optimized to workloads that are writing out really large files where they can really spread it across. So one of the nice things about DSMS is that it is file system based. We do a lot with MySQL. So there's basically a MySQL database that keeps track of every allocation. So what we call an allocation is essentially a directory that's been created by DSMS that has a symlink. And we have a makedir wrapper that you call and you say, I need a directory, and it needs to be this big and it's this type of data and everything. That typically isn't called by humans. It's called by these shot template scripts or possibly renders that are all scripted. And it does use MySQL for convenience, but it is a single point of failure. So we have what's called maintenance mode. And in maintenance mode, if it can't contact the database, it just kind of gets on with it. Within the link farm, there'll be a text file that'll contain a list of all the file systems that are available for that project. So if you don't have the database, all you have to do is read in that file, get a list of the file systems, find some that are of the type you want, CD to each, that'll force an auto mount, do a DF, see if it has enough space, get a list of all the ones that have enough space, pick one at random, and go make your directory. You write out all your metadata into a dot file, and you create the symlink from the link farm, and you're done. So even when the database goes down or we have to take it down for maintenance or something like that, you can still continue to create allocations. One of the important things is that you have to pick the file system randomly. So otherwise you get this sort of thundering herd effect where if you add a brand new file system that's quite empty, everything, all the new allocations start going onto it. So it's very random. You say, I need a gigabyte. Find any file system that says it has a gigabyte left, and you just pick one, even if it's relatively full. So to reconcile these, we don't have FSCK. We run, again, a Perl script. So there's a Perl script that runs every night, and it tries to reconcile the database and what's actually on the file system in the link farm. The important thing here is that the file system is the canonical source of metadata. So if the database finds that it has an inaccurate view of how things are on the file system, it fixes itself, not the file system. The file system's always right. So if the database is down for an hour and all these allocations get made, when it runs overnight, it'll find all those, realize that it's out of date, and update itself. So I mentioned before that we're kind of this cross between HPC and HA. One of the nice things about DSMS is that it has some really good high availability characteristics. So we put it on pretty good filers. We used to just have it as separate file systems on an existing source filer. But based on our experience with Avatar, after Avatar we took some pretty good NetApp 6080 file systems, put two or three shelves of disk on it, and leave those alone to only serve link farms. It's kind of an expensive way of handling the problem, but it works really, really well. So they don't have any other workload other than serving out the link farms and symlinks. So we can snapshot that. So if somebody goes in and destroys half the symlinks on the show, we can just go back to last hour's snapshot, and we're back up and running. We can back it up to tape. That's done. It's not that big. Again, 24 gigs, not a problem to back up. If we lost the entire file system and something went really crazily wrong, we essentially have a copy of it in MySQL. It's not really considered the authoritative source, but if we lose the authoritative source, all you have to do is run through the MySQL table and just find every allocation and just make a new symlink. It would take a couple hours, and we'd be back up and running. So that's really an important thing is looking at something like how fast is a restore from tape versus an FSCK. In some cases, it would actually probably just be easier to restore the whole file system from tape than it would be to try and run some sort of metadata FSCK. So one thing that that we have to do to free space up all the time are move files around, move directories around. We call these migrations. We have a lot of tools. We use one called DoRep that runs over the file systems every day and reports on the size of every allocation of every directory. And it puts those back into the database. So we can see which things are using up space and which file systems are full. And as file systems are full, we can simply move the data to a file system that's less full and change the symlink. And that's it. None of the tools need to know. None of the applications need to know. They'll just follow the symlink to the new location. But it's not atomic. It's not a same file system move. So what we tend to do is pick things that are older and probably not being accessed. We do a lot of this watching A times. That's how we know which things we can move around. So for each allocation, every night we'll check the A times as part of the disk space reporting. So our data managers can go on and say, you know, show me directories that haven't been accessed in a week, and I'm going to move those onto tape. Or they can say, this file system's really full. I need another 10 gigs on it. Find 10 gigs of old directories. I'll move them somewhere else. So it's a pretty simple process. We just copy the directory to the new file system. And then we do a series of rsyncs for 30 seconds on a 5-second delay and see if anything changes. If something changes, then we realize that it's in use and we bail out and leave it alone. If nothing changes for 30 seconds, we consider that safe. We go ahead and update the symlink in the link farm and then delete the original. So this is an example of what a shot directory looks like on avatar. So the path is proj avatar for project, shots, and it's a sequence and shot number. That one corresponds to the shuttle destruction scene. Hopefully most of you guys remember that. Hopefully I didn't give it away. And this is just a quick view of what the top-level directory looks like. There are a bunch of subdirectories, archive, art, cam, that all point off to other file systems. DSMS is the top-level auto-mount point, and some of them point to DAT file systems, DSMS DAT 331. Others point to source file systems, all depending on what they need. But it can go into subdirectories. It's not only one level. Down at the bottom, you can see, so the render directory has a whole bunch of subdirectories, and there'll be one render comp, and then different things inside that. And then they'll have version directories within that. V84 at the end of the directory name there is version 84. So that's the 84th iteration, and that points off to a DAT file system. So when the render goes, all the outputs go in there. One of the things that we brought in during Avatar to help with performance were NetApp's flex caches. We run into problems with hot data. So the render wall's job is to, as I said, to sort of process source into DAT. So it does a lot of reads at the beginning, pulling in models and textures and animation, everything that it needs. And then it pretty much stops reading, thinks about things for a while, and then starts writing out. What ends up happening is you grab 1,000 servers, and you say render the same sequence, and they all read in the same texture, they all read in the same model, they all read in the same animation. And that source file all of a sudden is slammed. While artists are trying to work on it. That's an artist filer. So we came up with a system years ago called a replica. So there's Vol Replica, which is another file system that's actually copied several times. So we'll just split it onto multiple filers and keep copies of commonly accessed data. The problem with that is we had to use something we call the publish system, which is basically publish scripts, where you run a script and you say, I've made this file. I think it's important. I think it's going to be commonly accessed data. Go ahead and copy it to these four locations. And then what we would do on the render wall is we would just use DNS round robin. So that when you try to mount the replica file system, you'll just get one of those four filers randomly. And with enough machines like we have, it would be a pretty even distribution. And that would split the load up. But then we have to have all sorts of tools that run to make sure they stay in sync, because what if a publish only accesses three? What if one of the files isn't accessible? Things can get out of sync. You know, what if the artist updates something and forgets to publish it? There are a lot of late night phone calls to artists saying, you forgot to publish something, and all of a sudden thousands of machines are trying to access it, and that filer is dead. So what we did during Avatar was we brought in Flex caches. So for any of you that aren't familiar with them, it's basically a NetApp filer. You attach a few shelves of disk, and it sits between the origin filer and your client, and it speaks a sort of proprietary protocol on the back end that's not quite NFS, and it passes through all the reads, gets the data from the source filer, and then caches it and puts it on its local disk, and then it has all these algorithms to determine what's sort of heavily used and what's not, and it just does write pass through. You can also get, they used to call them PAM cards, I think they're called flash cache cards now, which are sort of PCI-based flash memory. And those, for Avatar, we had 16 gigs of flash memory in each one. So it does further optimization of it, puts all the most commonly accessed data into flash memory, somewhat accessed data into disk, and then anything random, it'll just go back to the original one. And that was really good. That provided a buffer between the render wall and the source filers. So all of a sudden, if the render wall decided to load something up 1,000 times, the first one would access it, it would shove it into flash, and then everything else would just come out of flash, and the artist wouldn't notice a thing. We were doing that during Avatar. We put that in front of the replica system. So all the replicated data, instead of having it spread out over multiple file systems, we essentially had one copy of the replicated data and put a bunch of these flex caches in front of it. And again, use some DNS round robin so that the render wall mounts them all. Post Avatar, we actually did a few projects where even data that wouldn't ordinarily be published was being accessed quite a lot. So we bought a few more flex caches and put them in front of all the source file systems. So now the render wall never touches a source file system. It only touches a flex cache, which they can still destroy, but the artists don't notice. Just quickly, we also built a what we call a nearline file system during Avatar, which is a large amount, about a little over a petabyte of slow disk. And that comes in really handy towards the end of a production, when everything gets a little bit crazy. And artists are loath to commit to being done with anything. So typically we sort of work through and you say you're done, the director likes it, okay, we can clean that up, get most of the data off to tape, free up that disk for the next thing. But towards the end, they're not really sure. They say, I don't know, is the director gonna like that version or this version or that version? So they don't want to commit to putting anything. So what we can do is say, well, we think you're done with that. We'll put it onto slow disk. Because of DSMS, this was really trivial to implement. We already had the system in place. All we had to do was add a little bit of smarts into DSMS so that there were just different file systems. It could be source or it could be DAT. But they just had a characteristic of being slow. So the data managers could just say, move this onto a slow file system. It would do a migration just like any other. Move it onto there, change the symlink, it's done. You would know immediately if somebody started rendering from one of the nearline file systems because they just couldn't handle it. This is really slow disk, big, you know, one terabyte SATA drives. They can't do it. So all of a sudden you see really high load on the nearline filers. You find out what they're doing, and you go and you migrate that data back onto fast ones, and everything goes back to normal. The problem with large file systems and large amounts of slow disk is that with a petabyte of disk is kind of the new tape. At the data rates you can get on these things, it could take you 6 months to fill it. And you know, another 6 months to empty it. So we're starting to run into these limits of you kind of can't quite get everything onto it as fast as you would like. And then once the movie's done, you're trying desperately to get it off of that thing and onto tape before the next movie comes in, and there kind of really isn't enough time. So you have to watch it. It's easy these days to sort of get a large amount of disc, but performance is still really important. So I just wanted to show off a little tool that we wrote to use internally. I'll start talking about how we monitor these things. One of the things that we noticed is a sort of very common diagnostic tool, and it's not very advanced, right, is ping. And we used to do things like you would ping a file server and see how fast it was responding, and we could graph that. And that gave you some indication of how well it was responding. But these days, everything is multi-core. So it turns out that the core that's answering ICMP is often a completely different core or processor than the one that's handling the file system. And it can answer things really quickly while the filer is actually not responsive to NFS traffic. On a BlueArc, it's actually separate hardware that does it. So this is an example that I just did last week of the smoke ping program using our NFS ping tool, which essentially looks and acts just like fping. So it produces sort of computer parsable ping output. The top one is ICMP. Looks fine. Looks great. Whatever, looks average. So based on that, you would think the filer is okay. The bottom one is NFS ping, which actually shows that the file systems are in trouble. So all it does is there's a null command in the NFS NFS spec that essentially does nothing. You just send it and you get a response. And that's all it does, is it just sends an NFS null command and sees how fast the response comes back. But this is really good at sort of pinpointing problems and getting a little bit further into it. You still have to go then chase and see why it's doing it. And there still can be problems where of course, the NFS layer is responding fast, but if you're disk bound, you're still going to have trouble. But this is a really good tool that we like to use internally. I've actually just thrown this up on GitHub, if anybody's interested. Just search for NFS ping on GitHub. It's BSD licensed in case anybody wants to use it. And it integrates really nicely with smoke ping. Now that I've shown you that, I just wanted to show you a quick sort of performance graph. So this is just a benchmark I did really quickly of about the first 64,000 symlinks at the top of the avatar tree. So these are the results sort of sorted by response time left to right. The blue line is a read link. That's just following a symlink off the file system over NFS. The red line is doing a MySQL query. Because remember, we have a copy of all these in MySQL, so it's only a query away. You can say, you know, for this symlink, where does it go? And it'll tell you. The bottom line is just a baseline of what NFS ping says the file server is doing. That's really consistent. So you can see that in most cases, doing a read link is almost as fast as doing nothing. So all of that is just packet overhead. All of that is just round trip time getting to and from, parsing the packet at either end, you know, whatever. But readlink is extremely quick. MySQL is not too bad. It's doable, but there's a lot more overhead. You have to construct a query. You have to parse the query on the server. You have to look it up in the table. Even if you have it in cache, there's all kinds of stuff. So the response time is you know, still acceptable. We're still under a millisecond most of the time. But it's nowhere near what we can get with a read link. So I can't really think of anything that we could do that would really be faster from a performance point of view. So having this whole symlink interaction turns out just to be a non-issue. We have a wrangling department that monitors and maintains the render wall and watches over all the jobs. They're called wranglers. Wranglers used to be the people that would take care of the horses on a film set. Now they take care of renders. This is a page that they've written that all of them stare at all day long. It's just some Python on the back end. This lists all our sort of active filers at the time. It'll start to color code things. Yellow means, you know, it's slowing down. Red means it's broken. And this shows all the operations and does a lot of metrics internally, so they can watch this and find out where there are problems. Now, in the old days, what we would do is when you found a problem on a filer, the hard part with these all NFS servers is finding out what's going on. It's really difficult to ask it. You can say somebody's writing a whole bunch, and you go, who? It doesn't really want to tell you. In our case, we can more easily say, where are they writing? Because of the directory structures that we have, it has the shot name, it has the sequence name, it has the project. Everything is in the path. So we can find out where the writing is going on. We can just correlate that back to the job system and say, what renders are going on for that shot? And then they can throttle those renders down and starve them of CPU until the performance comes back. And possibly go back to the artist and say, something's broken here. You're doing something wrong. It's quite common for renders sometimes to get stuck, where they'll get into like an infinite loop, or they'll just be doing something wrong and just start eating CPU and just writing out a whole bunch of junk. So in the old days, what we would do to find this stuff is we run a packet trace on the NFS server, on the filer. You just run a packet trace for 60 seconds, take it out, pump it through a script that understands how to parse NFS packets, and you start getting a list of directory names. Then once you have all those directory names, you can go back and correlate that to a job. Unfortunately, for performance reasons, we turned on what's called TOW, which is TCP offload, on the NetApp filers during Avatar. That gave us a big boost in network performance. Essentially what it does is it offloads some of the TCP stack onto the NIC. But what that means is that the filer doesn't actually see all the parts of the packet that it should. So packet tracing doesn't work anymore. You can't really do a packet dump on it. You're only seeing partial information. And all the tools that try to parse out the NFS data break. So we had to come up with something else. What we did was we sort of turned it around and started doing it on the client side. So there's a file in PROC, PROC being the sort of, I guess, human-readable version of the kernel. This isn't entirely human-readable, but it's computer-readable. But there's a file, PROC self mount stats. If you cat that, it has an entry like this for every file system that you have mounted. And what this does is it shows all the NFS operations that are going on. So what you can do is just run this, wait 10 seconds, run it again, get the deltas, and see all that. And the Wranglers have built a system they call OWL, which uses AMQP to send all that data back to a centralized point where it's all reported here. So all the ops per second data that's on this page here is actually coming from the clients, not from the NFS servers. So again, you may sense a theme here. It's vendor agnostic. So bringing in a new file server or a new version that breaks the old functionality or anything like that isn't affected because it's all happening on the client. The other thing is when there's a problem, you can just click on the name of the filer, and it knows exactly which clients are reading and writing to it, or doing any of those operations. So it can just show you a sorted list. And then from there, it's not hard to correlate which, you know, I have 100 machines that are writing to this filer that are probably causing the problem. Let me correlate that back to what jobs are running on that filer. You don't actually need to know the directory anymore. Now, the servers can be running 3 or 4 jobs. But statistically, you should be able to correlate it and find it. So coming up, the next challenge for us is dealing with the problem that we have at the end of the show, where we lose a lot of the parallelism that we built into this. The ultimate example of this is the final shot of the movie, which is just trying to get out the door. So there's only one thing going, and they have the entire render wall at their disposal, and oftentimes it's pointing at a single directory. We really get our parallelism by having a lot of distinct jobs running on the wall, sort of doing things all over the place. If you try to do one thing, you can still overwhelm it. So one of the things that we're working on for DSMS now is adding sort of another level of indirection and going to a per frame system, where instead of all the renders outputting their data into a single directory, they'll split it up and have one directory for each frame of output. So that way, when you have a bunch of machines rendering out, they'll still be hitting separate file systems. One of the problems with this is that all the tools out there expect all the frames to be in the same directory. So for example, if you want to play that movie back, a lot of the tools expect you to hand it a directory name. It'll go in there and find a sequence list of files and play them back. So we fix this maybe in a predictable way by making a master directory and symlinking to all the individual frames. So all your legacy tools can still go into a single directory and find everything they want. And I'll just say, one of the other things we learned during Avatar was about full file systems. Even though we have a lot of disk, we tend to run the file systems really full, especially as things get busy. And with creating sort of 40 T a day, we sort of create that overnight, and during the day try to delete it and kind of get back. But a lot of times we really, I mean, the facility has gone down to having, you know, 100 gigabytes of free disk. So what we found is that performance sort of hits this tipping point on most file systems. It's dependent on the manufacturer. But once you get up above 90%, into 95, into 98, and all of a sudden it'll just grind to a halt as it's trying to find free blocks. And that won't affect just that one file system, it can affect the entire filer. So every file system mounted there will start to go slow. So if you have a runaway job, which does happen, so we have runaway jobs that just start writing and writing and writing more than they should, they can fill up a file system and really destroy performance. So we found that the best thing to do is just not to let people do that. So we, on a NetApp, you can do snap reserve. So even if you're not running snapshots on that file system, like we wouldn't be on a DAT where these writes are happening, you can still tell the filer to like reserve the last 5 or 10% of that file system and don't allocate anything into it. And then even when it gets to what DF will say is 100% full, it's actually still got that 5 or 10% at the end where it can find free blocks, and it's still functional. BlueArc has a really similar thing called FS usage, where you can reserve space, and it just hides it from people, so nobody else in the facility knows. It's sort of the sysadmin secret of where that space has gone. But that can really prevent a lot of problems if you end up having to deal with full file systems. Some other stuff we're working on in the future is automatic migrations for file system leveling. Right now it's a manual process. As we see a file system filling up, someone will go find old data, move it around. We're gonna start to make that an automatic process. So just all the time there'll be this background thing moving stuff around so that every file system hopefully is about the same amount full. We're hoping to avoid the whole sort of PNFS, NFS4 thing. The sort of office joke is that we'll do NFS4 over our IPv6 network. I'm not sure I'll be around to see either. Yeah, just kind of personally, I when I look at some of these things, I have a 10-year rule about it. You know, if nobody's using a spec within 10 years, it's probably time for a rethink. IPv6 came out in December of 98. NFS-V4 is December of 2000. So we have 1 month to get everybody onto it. And The final thing, talking about the future, we're still making movies. Some of you may have heard we're going to make The Hobbit. We may be doing Avatar 2 and 3 after that. 3D is the future, at least for us. We're making a movie now, Tintin, directed by Steven Spielberg. It's fully 3D. We're sort of acknowledged as one of the leaders in that space. 3D makes things difficult. It's twice as big, two eyes. And the frame sizes are going up. Avatar wasn't really a particularly high-resolution movie. The cameras that they used to film it were only HD. It still looks really good, but there are better cameras coming out all the time. As any of you that buy, you know, digital cameras for your home know, the megapixels are going way up. So it's about 12 megs a frame for Avatar. There's a new digital camera called the Red, which is for film use only. Well, not film, but movies. And a 5K frame off a Red camera is 84 megs. That's significantly larger. One of the other things that helps with stereo 3D is increasing the frame rate. Things look a lot smoother as things pan from side to side. So that's one of the things that we're testing and Hollywood is really looking at. High frame rates aren't out of the question, but even something like going to 48 frames a second, that's 48 frames a second each eye. So you take the standard 24 frames a second, double it for stereo, and then double the frame rate again. With that 5K Red frame that I talked about before, that's 8 gigabytes a second of data coming off the camera. And that's 8 gigabytes of data that we have to generate for each second of film. But as I think I've showed, there's a lot of data behind the scenes that doesn't make it on the screen. So I think that's all I have. Just wanted to say thanks to everybody back in New Zealand that helped make all this possible. They're doing the hard work. Any questions?
Hi, I'm Don Johnson from NetApp. Thank you for helping send my children to college. This is a sysadmin question, not a sales question, because I'm a sysadmin. Really? Don't I look like one? The difference between the BlueArcs and the NetApps in your environment, could you say a little bit about what roles they're playing, why you selected each one, pros and cons, you know, what do you like better here, what do you hate here? or is that a dirty question to ask?
No, I didn't really have a vendor sort of war, but I'll answer your question.
Okay.
since you've asked. BlueArcs are really good for performance. They're really good for write performance, especially. At the time that we were doing Avatar, they were the only thing that could sort of hold up to the render wall in a kind of reasonable way. The NetApps are really the only thing we trust with our human-generated data. They just are super reliable, super stable. And really, the whole FlexCache architecture really changed our entire network during Avatar and really kind of saved us. So that was amazing. The stuff they're doing with flash memory, especially, has been really great. So the basic division for us is generally source goes onto a NetApp and DAT goes onto a BlueArc. But it's all subject to market cycles. So NetApp has a brand new box that just came out yesterday that looks really good.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier on in the talk about we couldn't re-render, you know, LOTR because the tools have changed so much. Mm. Has there been any thought of tying in, you know, some configuration management of, you know, this is the software code and version that was used to set up this frame and render it, or is that like overhead you just don't even need?
People do think about it sometimes.
Okay.
Asset management is one of the things we're not great at. I think the way it's thought about from the top probably is that it's not their problem. So from a producer's point of view, who's trying to get this movie made, the sequel isn't their problem. That's somebody else's budget. So if the sequel has to go back and spend time reconstructing what they did, that's fine, but they're not going to proactively spend people's time making things easier for a movie that may or may not happen, if you know what I mean. So it's more of a business thing than a real technical thing. Nobody's asking us to do it.
Right. If it was an engineering situation.
If it was an engineering thing, we could do it. And we probably would want to, because you say, well, I might need to redo this someday. But I think based on my experience, in actuality, they wouldn't really want to mess with it. They look back at the old stuff, even when it comes back off tape, and go like, oh God, we did it that way? Like, why, you know? There's so many advances. I mean, if you look at how they did Gollum and how they did Neytiri, same sort of techniques, but completely different. So they would never just go back and grab Gollum the way he was and say, let's make a new movie with that. If you put the two of them side to side, there's no comparison. So they're gonna want to bring them up to modern standards.
Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Deke Klinger with Qualcomm. I gathered from context and your comments that you're using a lot of Linux and AutoMount and NFS, and I was just wondering, have you had any problems with the Linux AutoMounter, and if so, how have you dealt with them?
Yeah, we actually have had many problems with the Linux AutoMounter. We're still using AutoMount 4.
My condolences.
We actually find that it's much better and much easier to work with than version 5. It's a little bit simpler and more straightforward. So our guys that work on it, because it's, I think I'm getting this right, but 4 was multi-process and 5 was multi-threaded.
Correct.
Yeah. So when something crashes on 4, you get a core dump. You fire up GDB. You find out what's going on. When something goes wrong on 5, it's really difficult to sort of attach to that and figure out, which thread is responsible for the file system that I'm having trouble with. What the hell is it doing? So from that standpoint, the simpler architecture is a little bit easier. But we do have a sort of internal fork of that, where we've been making a lot of fixes. I mean, some of the stuff is just some of the stuff we've done around mounts and everything. We tend to get these big mount storms. If you reboot the render wall or something, all of a sudden everybody tries to mount it. We've found a lot of stuff. We try to get the port mapper out of the way if we can. I mean, the port mapper was maybe a great idea back in the day, but 2049 is like port 80. It's just like every NFS server is listening on 2049. Why bother to ask it which port it's listening on? Just do it on 2049 and get it over with. And the AutoMounter does some funny stuff, like we use TCP mounts. Even if you do a TCP mount, it'll still send some UDP to try and figure out which mount is healthiest, if presented with multiple options, which is what happens when we have the replicas or flex caches and you do this DNS stuff. It gets the whole list from DNS and sort of talks to all of them and says, this one seems the healthiest. But it'll try it over UDP first and then do it over TCP. So we've done stuff like we've just said, if it's a TCP mount, just never send it UDP, because we do have an oversubscribed network and things do go missing. So the UDP will disappear and then you're waiting for the mount. Yeah, so I guess that's a long way of saying we have had problems. We found solutions for most of them. I don't think we're done. Our version of 4 seems to be okay.
Can you talk a little bit about the sizes of your AutoMount maps and what you're using to deliver them? Are you using LDAP or files?
Yeah, it's LDAP.
Okay.
They're not huge. We tend to build fairly decent-sized file systems. I mean, a lot of the file systems are kind of 6 to 8 T. So, when you take a filer and split it up into chunks like that, I'm trying to think. I mean, you could see some of the numbers there. We have like DAT 331 or something like that. Like, we're up into the hundreds, but we're not into the thousands.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Yep. When I first started this question, it seemed a little funny, but I'm sorry. I'm Brian Galou with Copart. How long do you think it's going to be before you're competing with CERN for data?
I think in some ways we probably already are. I mean, no disrespect. I mean, we can generate a lot of data, and then we throw a lot of it away. They're in the business of collecting data and holding on to it so that they can analyze it. We're more on this cycle of, you know, we really need to hold on to the stuff when we get to the final version. You know, when James Cameron says, like, yep, that's the one that's going on film, we grab that. And all the sort of iterations of that went into getting to that point, we can just throw away. So we're constantly sort of fighting this running battle, which I think gives us a little bit easier. If we actually had to store everything that we had generated over the entire course of Avatar, it would have been, you know, 10 petabytes. But because we were able to sort of cycle through it, we're able to stay on top of things.
Thank you.
So 2 points. You said that it takes about 6 months to drain the disk farm. Is it perhaps more efficient to just archive the disks?
It would be more efficient. It would cost more, I guess. Obviously, right? Of just forklifting off a system when you're done with the movie and putting it in a corner.
There's various costs. You know, you've got time is a cost in of itself, and so is tape.
Yeah, so it works okay for us because of the sort of cyclical nature of our schedules. Like, we tend to do these big sort of tentpole movies and then kind of take a break, and all the artists go off on vacation for a couple months, and, you know, it takes a while for the facility to sort of gear back up for another big movie. So we have the luxury of having 6 months to be able to do that. If we had to go from movie to movie to movie, which is what we're actually kind of facing over the next few years, we probably will have to look at something like that.
The other thing, you mentioned sometimes you get runaway processes just filling up a filer. Mm. Have you thought about putting like file system quotas in so that they can't take the whole thing over? You said you had some idea about amount they should be writing, so that's why I thought it might be possible.
Yeah, we have looked at file system quotas in the past. I mean, nothing's quoted now. It's all managed by this sort of DSMS thing, but you're right, it can't sort of clamp. It can't clamp off a process when it sees it kind of going crazy. I think that's something we would handle outside of the quota system, probably. One of the things we're moving towards is more, instead of sort of nightly disk stats, is moving to sort of more real-time disk stats. So finding out who's doing it. And because we're doing the sort of client-side stats collecting now for NFS, it's pretty easy to actually isolate a particular blade and say, oh my God, you've written 100 gigs in the past, you know, hour or something. What the hell job are you running that's doing that? So I think we'd probably stay away from the quota stuff and implement it a different way.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Hugh Brown from the University of British Columbia. You had a graph showing the difference between NFS ping, regular ping, and MySQL response times. The MySQL response time, as you saw, was sort of this gentle curve up, and the NFS ping sort of went real flat and then whoosh. Mm. If that corresponds to performance, and if that sudden steep climb means that you suddenly have problems, does that lack of graceful degradation, that lack of warning, cause you any problems? And is that a trade-off you've made?
No, I think the one that has the spike right at the end is read link.
Sorry.
My best guess is what's going on there is those are when it will descend into directories. As it sort of hits a top-level directory with a whole bunch of subdirectories, you sort of take this hit, pulling that in. But then once it's in, then you start asking for all the things in the subdirectories, and it's already got that done. So I tried to sort of smooth the graph out by sorting it by response time. If you look at the actual time series data, it's like low, 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 and they'll just be sort of a high one, then low, 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 high, low, 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 high, and it's really intermittent. But even when it gets high, the top end is really pretty containable. I mean, it'll be maybe 2 milliseconds or something like that. Where with something like MySQL, it's a database system. It could be doing anything. If somebody else is running another query, I mean, I sort of chopped the top of that off because I didn't want to make it look too bad, but some of the responses were like 5 seconds. And that's just because it's a database system and it's doing something else random. If we were running the symlinks on an actual file system that was running reads and writes, we would have that sort of performance problem because the file system might be busy doing a bunch of writes, so it's not going to get to your symlink very quickly. But we fixed that by first putting it onto its own file system that doesn't have to do those things, and then putting it onto its own hardware that never has to worry about that stuff. So.
Hi, Jim Kavitsky, Brocade Communications. I was wondering if you tracked any of the traffic profiles of your NFS, for instance, in terms of the percentage of GET attribute traffic that you see due to the type of file systems that you're running and all the symlinks that are involved. You know what kind of percentages you're running, and are you happy with what you're seeing?
We do track that stuff now because, again, we have this sort of client-side monitoring that tracks it like per call. So all that's going into a statistics database. We have looked at it and haven't really seen anything anomalous, but it does give us a good baseline. Of sometimes when we see a problem going on with the file system and we can't really track it down to a particular issue, or if we see a problem on multiple file systems, which happens sometimes, like somebody will write a new tool that does something crazy, that makes a whole bunch of directories and then deletes them or something like that, and we can actually sort of go back historically and see that, we weren't really making that many make directory calls yesterday, why are we making so many today, and try to go find out where that's happening.
Matthew Barr, MarketServe. I'm wondering if you guys have looked at PNFS at all?
We have looked at it from a distance. I think it solves a different problem than we have. I mean, I think we've solved a lot of the low-hanging fruit that PNFS sort of promises to solve. I did have a slide in there somewhere sort of showing our file size distribution, and I think things like PNFS and even Lustre or whatever are tend to work better with larger files. So for someplace like us that deals with a significant number of small files, there's not really a big win. Just like everybody else, we're waiting to see. I mean, it's not really here yet, is it? I mean, everybody keeps saying it's coming, but,
I think our best bet's probably Rails 6 for the first time it's going out into the real world.
Yeah, but then once the manufacturers get theirs and get it all interop with the clients and...
It should be interesting.
It's going to be interesting, but I put me down in the skeptical category.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for your time, everybody.